Chapter 14. A Tale of Repression. Rogue. Return to the Flame Hills.
"We've not been idle," Beckwin told me with a smirk when we returned to the gun cutter.
It was noon, and the river basin was filling with bumping clusters of ball trees driven off the flint plains by the wind. They drifted over the shingle and splashed trailing roots into the water. Beckwin was dressed in work fatigues, a rebreather slung around her neck, and she carried an auto pistol. As Midas and Fischig stowed the speeder under the netting, she led me into the crew bay and waved the weapon in the direction of a thin, filthy man chained to a cargo loop with cuff restraints. His hair was matted, and his clothes, an assemblage of patched rags, were stiff with caked mud. He looked at me with fierce eyes through a shaggy fringe of wet hair.
"There were three of them, maybe more," Beckwin told me. "Came to take a look at us, using the ball trees as moving cover. The others fled, but I brought him down."
"How?" I asked. She gave me that look, which told me not to keep underestimating her. "Our intruders from last night?" I wondered aloud. Beckwin shrugged. I walked over to face the captive. "What's your name?"
"He doesn't say much," Beckwin advised.
I told her to move away. "Name?" I asked again.
"Nothing."
I paused, collected my mind, and then sent a gentle probe into the shady recesses of his skull.
"Thomas Rizo," he stammered.
"Good." Another gentle push at his slowly yielding mind. The levels of fear and caution were palpable.
"Of Gillenys Acre. Goddesland."
I switched to speech, without the psychic urge now. "Gillen's Acre? You mean Gillen's Acre?"
"Say the Gillen his acre."
"Gillen's Acre?" He nodded.
"Thee's the truth."
"Proto-Gothic, with generational nuance shift," Amos said, coming near. "Damask was colonized something over 500 years ago, and was isolated for a lengthy period. The population may not have flourished, but the language has perpetuated vestiges of older lingua forms."
"So this man is likely to be a native? A settler?" Amos nodded. I saw our captive was looking from my face to Amos's, trying to follow our conversation. "You were born here, on Damask," he frowned.
"Born here? I am of Gillen his acre, yet be goddess land afore the working."
I looked round at Amos. This would take forever.
"I can manage," Amos said. "Ask away."
"Ask him what happened to Gillen's acre."
"Prithee, how can be lossen Gillen his acre?"
His story was painfully simple, and shaped by the ignorance of a man whose kind had worked the poor soil of a lonely edge world for generations. The families, as he called them, presumably the clan groups of the original settlers, had worked the land for as long as his memory and the memory of his elders went. There were 5 farming communities and 2 quarries or mines, which provided building materials and fossil fuel in exchange for a share of the crops. They were devout people, dedicated to the nurture of goddess land, God's land, though there was no doubt that by God they meant the God Emperor. As little as 4 years ago, after the time of the last survey from which records we worked, there had been upwards of 9,000 settlers living in the communities of Damask. Then the mission came. Rizal reckoned this to have been 3 years before. A ship brought a small order of ecclesiarchs here from Messina. They intended to establish a retreat and spiritually educate the neglected settlers. There had been 30 priests. He recognized the name Datso.
"Archipriest Datso," he called him.
Other off-worlders came too, not priests like Datso and his brethren, but men who worked with them. From the way he described them, they sounded like geological surveyors or mining engineers. They concentrated their attentions on the quarries at North Quam. After about a year, the activity increased. More ships came and went. Settlers, mostly strong males, were recruited from the farm communities to work the mines, often brutally. The ecclesiarchs didn't seem to mind. As their populations drained, the farming settlements began to fail and die off. No help was given to sustain them. A disease, probably an off-world import, killed many. Then the volcanic activity began, suddenly, without warning. Everyone in the farmsteads was rounded up and pressed into service at the pits, as if some great urgency was now driving the task. Rizer and many like him toiled until they dropped, and later managed to escape, living like animals in the thorn forests.
So Datso and his mission had come to Damask, enslaved the population into a workforce, and were now hell-bent on mining out something from the territory around North Quam. It seemed likely to me that the volcanism had been triggered by incautious mining work. I reached into his mind again. He trembled in fear as he felt the psychic touch, and showed him an image of Datso. Eagerly, he confirmed his identity. Then, Locke, another face he knew, and regarded with ill-concealed hatred. Locke had been chief among the men who had pressed the farmers into service. His cruelty had left a lasting mark. I showed him the faces of Uricel and Oberon Glore, neither of which were known to him. At last, I visualized an image of the pipe-smoking man.
"Malahite,"
he announced, recognizing him at once. According to Rizor, the obscura addict with the watery blue eyes was Girolamo Malahite, chief of the surveyors and engineers. Fischig, who had joined us during the conversation, asked about the fiberwood marker we had found at Gillen's Acre. Rizor wrinkled his face with grief. That had marked the mass grave where the offworlders had buried all those who had resisted. Midas called me to the cockpit. I told Amos to feed Rizor and question him further. Midas sat in the leather pilot's throne, his lap draped with spools of scroll papers stamped out of the electric press.
"No wonder Maxilla hid," he said by way of an opening. "Look here."
The scrolls were a transcription log of the astropathic and vox traffic Midas had been able to monitor from the ships in orbit. He slid a gloved finger down the jumbled columns of figures and text.
"I make out at least 12 vessels up there, maybe more. It's difficult to say an accurate figure. These here, for example, may be 2 ships in dialogue or the same ship repeating itself."
"Coding?"
"That's the interesting bit. It's all standard Imperial, the Navy code called Texcept."
"That's common enough." He nodded.
"And look here. The question and answer pattern indicates a capital ship checking that its fleet components have all arrived in real space. It's a typical Imperial structure. Military. One of ours."
"A friendly fleet?"
"Not friendly, perhaps. Look at the command identifier here. That name translates as Estrum."
"The missing captain?"
"The missing captain. Perhaps not that missing after all. Perhaps Rogue. The whole incident at Gudrun Anchorage, the mistaken recognition, the panic, could have been an excuse to withdraw ships loyal to him.
But he's still broadcasting in standard Imperial code form.
If his officers alone are party to the deceit, he won't want to alert the crews."
An hour later, a large launch with fighter escort broke from the fleet and swung down to the surface of Damask. The transport set down at North Quam, and the fighters circled the area twice before returning to their base ship. From the cutter, we could hear the booming roar of their thrusters rolling around the plateau and valleys. Midas quickly switched the cutter's systems to minimum operation so they wouldn't make a chance detection of our instrumentation. Amos talked with Rizor for most of the afternoon, and he seemed calmer and more willing to help once food had been given to him. As the light began to fail and evening approached, Amos came to find me.
"If you want a way back in, that man might be able to help you."
"Go on."
"He knows the mines and the excavations. He worked there for a goodly while. I've spoken to him at length, and he seems certain he could show you to a cave network that links with the mining structure."
We set out after dark in the speeder. Fischig drove, using the terrain scanner to see, rather than the lamps. That made progress slower but more discreet. I sat next to him, and Beckwin rode in the back with Rizor. There had been some debate about which of us should go, but I had made the final selection. The speeder could hold 4, and though Midas was the most able combatant in my group, more able than even the Chastener, in my view, I wanted him at the helm of the cutter, ready to respond. Besides, Beckwin had uses of her own that I considered vital to our endeavour. It took a long time to make the trek back to the North Quam region, and we didn't arrive until well into the second half of the night. Clouds had masked the sky, hiding the moon and stars, and the only light was the flare of the volcanic hills, underlighting the low clouds with a fluctuating red haze. The air was thick with sulphurous smoke. We left the speeder concealed in a hollow, its position flagged by a marker tag, and headed west around the outreaches of the area, the Flame Hills, as Rizor called them. Nocturnal creatures chattered and fluted in the darkness. Something larger and more distant howled. Pressing through the thorn scrub, we became aware of the harsh artificial lighting bathing the entire settlement. The volcanoes rumbled. It took Reiser a little time to find what he was looking for, a series of small shallow pools, half filled with geothermally heated water. The syrupy surfaces of the pools seethed and bubbled, and the site was plagued with insects drawn by the heat. Reiser splashed cautiously into the largest pool and worked his way around a massive boulder that was swathed in bright orange lichen. Behind it, masked by thorn and cycad, was a narrow cavity. This, he said, as best as I could understand him, was the route by which he had escaped from the slave gangs. We checked weapons and equipment and prepared to enter. I had opened the weapons locker on the cutter and provided us with as much efficient firepower as we could comfortably manage. I had my power sword, an auto pistol in a rig under my coat, and a las carbine with a lamp pack taped under the muzzle. Other items of equipment filled the pack on my back. Beckwin had kept her auto pistol and taken a flat-bladed knife, and she too had a lamp. I'd given Fischig an old but well-maintained heavy stubber, which seemed to please him enormously. He had his RBT's pistol and a satchel full of spare ammo drums for the stubber. Reiser had refused a weapon. I was certain he would leave us once we were safely en route anyway. The cavity allowed us to enter single file. I led the way, with Reiser behind me, then Beckwin, and Fischig brought up the rear. It was damnably hot in the narrow rock passage, and the sulphurous gases forced us to wear our rebreathers. Reiser had no breather, but tied a swathe of cloth around his nose and mouth. This was the practice the slaves had used when working the mines. The passage wound back and forth, and climbed for a while as it coiled into the hill. In places, it was so steep we had to climb up the ragged floor of the burrow. Twice we had to remove our equipment packs to ease through constricted sections. After an hour, I began to feel the oppressive throb of the psychic veil shrouding North Quam. As we penetrated it, I listened out for the sound of alarms or activity, but none came. Though she didn't know it, Beckwin was already doing her job by creating a dead spot that allowed us to press on invisibly. I made sure none of us strayed too far from her aura of influence. The lava flues were crawling with life forms adjusted to existence in the hot, chemical-rich environment. Blind, toad-like hunters, transparent beetles, albino mollusks, and spiders that looked like they were fashioned from white gold. A fat, pallid centipede, as long as my arm, spurred its way over the baked rock at one junction. Every few minutes the earth trembled. Loose rock and dust showered down from the roof, and warm, reeking gases blew back along the winding rock halls. The passage widened and showed signs of excavation. Thornwood props supported the ceiling, and marker boards with numbers chalked on them were nailed to every sixth post. Reiser tried to explain where we were. He did his best, and I was able to ascertain we were in a section of mine that had been worked and then abandoned. He said other things, too, but the meaning was beyond me. He led us to the end of one working, a low, propped tunnel, and I shone my light into a cavity that had been dug out of the loose shale and grit. Beckwin knelt and brushed grit off the floor with her hand. She exposed old tiles made of a dull metallic substance I couldn't identify. The tiles were perfectly fitted, despite the fact that they were irregular octagons. They were strangely unsymmetrical, with some edges overlong. Yet they all fitted almost seamlessly. We could not begin to account for it, and the pattern they made was intensely uncomfortable. At the rear of the cavity, ancient stonework had been exposed. I was no expert, but the stone, a hard, pale material glittering with flecks of mica, didn't look local. There was evidence that parts of it had been cut away with rock drills and cutting beams.
"This is old," said Fischig.
He ran his hand across the riven stone facing.
"But the damage is new."
"The wheel graves,"
Elizabeth Beckwin said suddenly. I looked over at her.
"On Bonaventure,"
she explained, remembering her homeworld.
"There were famous old sites in the western hills, made by races before man. They were arranged in radiating circles like wheels. I used to go there when I was a child. They had been decorated once, I suppose, but the surfaces had been cut away, ransacked by later hands. It reminds me of this."
"There are many who make a trade in archaeological plunder," said Fischig, "and if it's Xenos artifacts, the penalty is high."
I'd overheard Glore and his allies mention archaeo-xenon materials. If this was such a site, connected in some way to the as-yet-mysterious Zaruthi, It accounted for the way they persisted in working it despite the volcano. What had they taken from here? What was it worth to them? What was it worth to the Zaruthi? We retraced our steps back to the main seam, passing three more abandoned cavities. Each one had shown signs of the old stonework, and each had been robbed like the first. We came to the end of the seam, and a metal ladder rose up through scaffolding to an opening in the rock 10 meters up. We climbed up into another tunnel, and at once heard the rattle of rock drills. The atmosphere was clearer here, and we were able to remove our rebreathers. Cold air, from the surface, I guessed, breezed down the tunnel. With extreme caution, we passed along, crossing the mouth of a gigantic cavern that had probably been a magmatic reservoir. The walls were polished and fused by heat. Crouching low, we looked in, and saw work gangs of men and women, undoubtedly Riser's kinfolk, forming basket chains to clear rock debris from the workface. There were at least a dozen of the bestial guards in their black, spiked armour. One walked the work line and administered encouragement with an electro-lash. I peered in more intently and tried to make sense of the main working. Two Damascite slaves worked with rock drills, cutting back the crust of wall, exposing a wide stretch of the old stone facing. Other slaves, most of them women, laboured closely on the exposed section with small picks, awls and brushes, revealing carvings of intricate design. A relay of shouts ran down the guard line, and we hid ourselves in the tunnel shadows. From up ahead, lamps bobbed and wove, and a party of men came down the tunnel from the surface into the cavern. Three were guards, two grey-shrouded supervisors with data slates. The others were Gorgone Locke and the pipe smoker, Girlamo Malahite. As I suspected, members of the Glor Cabal had escaped House Glor alive. Estrom's rogue fleet had no doubt played a part in that salvation. Locke was dressed in a leather robe with armoured panels woven into it. His mouth still showed the wound I had inflicted there. His mood was sullen. Malahite was dressed in black as I had seen him before. He stood, studying data slates, conferring with the dig supervisors and the leader of the guard team before moving to look at the exposed stretch of archaeoxenon material. The slave workers shrank back out of his way. He exchanged a few words with the men around him, and the guard leader hurried off, returning with a bulky rock saw. The tool trailed cables and tubes behind it, back to a socket junction at the mouth of the cavern, where it linked to a system of power and water supply lines running back up the tunnel to the generators and pumps at the surface. The saw whined into life, pumping a sheen of water over its blade to keep it clean and cool. The guard leader carefully sliced the blade into the rock, the saw keening as it bit. In a few seconds he had cut a slice of the carvings free. As far as I could tell, the carvings were made on individual stone blocks, and he was slicing the sculpted faces off the stones. He cut two more, and they were passed with reverence to Malahite, who studied them and then handed them on to be wrapped in plastic and placed in wooden carriers. The slices looked very much like the old stone tablets I had seen in that private study under House Glor. There was a loud crack. The guard leader had cut another tablet away, but it had broken into fragments. He dropped the saw and began to collect up the fragments frantically as those around him cursed and shouted. Locke moved in. He kicked the man hard and dropped him to the ground, then kicked him repeatedly as he lay there, trying to shield his face, begging for mercy. Malahite gathered up the fragments.
"You were told to be careful, you useless bastard," Locke was growling. "It can be repaired," Malahite told the shipmaster. "I can fuse it together."
Locke wasn't listening. He kicked the man again, then dragged him up and threw him against the wall. He cursed at him some more, and the man whimpered, pleading apologies. Locke turned away from the battered wretch. Then he picked up the revving saw, swung back, and dismembered the guard leader. It was inhuman. The agonized screams filled the chamber. All the slaves wailed and moaned, and even the guards looked away in distaste. Locke laid in with murderous glee, covering himself in blood. Then he tossed the smoking saw onto the ground at his feet and turned to another of the guards. He pointed to the saw.
"Make sure you do a better job," he snarled.
With huge reluctance, the guard picked up the saw and set to work. Locke, Malahite, and their party left after another 10 minutes, followed by a work gang carrying the wooden crates full of cut tablets. We waited a few minutes, then followed them up the tunnel. There was daylight ahead, scarce and thin. The tunnel came up into what I had guessed was the large modular shed I had seen from my reconnaissance. Workers milled around on rest breaks, and guards and the grey-robed overseers wandered back and forth. Dig equipment and tools were piled up in the poorly lit shed. Fischig found a door at the back of the shed, behind equipment boxes, and broke the lock. The four of us were able to slip out of the shed from the rear into the settlement, without having to pass through the main mine entrance and thus be seen. We were now in a back lane of North Quam, with the volcano slopes behind us. Rotting and abandoned buildings stood close all around, and flurries of ash and soot blew down over us. We kept close to the walls, holding back out of sight when anybody passed. Behind the next jumble of ruins lay a cleared area, partly masked by more flakboard screens, designed to keep the ash out. Two launches sat on the scorched ground, a large Imperial Navy transport and a smaller, older shuttle. A thicker layer of ash coated the older shuttle's hull. Figures moved around the entry ramps of both ships. Guards and workers were moving the wooden stretchers of excavated artifacts up into the belly hold of the Navy launch. I could see Locke and Malahide standing nearby, with several of the supervisors and three battlefleet officers in shipboard fatigues. One, a lean man with a receding chin and bulging eyes, wore the ribbons and insignia of a captain, our rogue, Estrom. As I watched, the Ecclesiarch Datso emerged from a nearby building and crossed to them, holding the hem of his rich gown up out of the ash. Shouting suddenly boomed across the yard, an angry human voice followed by a deeper, more savage sound that set the hairs on my neck up. Lord Oberon Glor, dressed in a cloak and body armor, slammed out of the building Datso had emerged from, striding across the landing yard. A second later, the huge, ghastly bulk of the Chaos Space Marine followed him, raging and cursing. Glor wheeled and faced the giant monster, resuming his argument at the top of his voice. For all his size, the Lord of House Glor was dwarfed by the vividly armored blasphemy. The traitor marine had removed his helmet. His face was a white, powdered, lifeless mask of hate, with smears of gold dust and purple skin paint around the hollow eyes, and a dry, lipless mouth full of pearl-inlaid teeth. His only vaguely human face seemed to have been suited onto his skull, the exposed parts of which were machined gold. There was a terrible stink of cloying perfume and organic corruption. I could not imagine the courage or insanity that it took to face down a Chaos Space Marine in a furious argument. The wind was against us, and all we could hear was the violent snarl of the voices instead of actual words. Datso and Malahide quickly crossed to Glor's side, and most of the other guards and workers present cowered back. The wind changed a little.
"Will not deny me any longer, you human filth!"
the awful voice of the traitor marine could suddenly be heard.
"You will show me respect, Mandragore! Respect!"
Glor yelled back, his voice powerful but seemingly frail against the roar of the Chaos Warrior. The marine bellowed something else that ended in,
"Slay you all and finish this work myself. My masters await, and they await the perfect completion of this task. They will not idle their time while you vermin dawdle and slacken. You will abide by our pact. You will keep to our agreement."
I realized I had almost become hypnotized, staring at the monstrous, raging figure, drawn to him by his power and sheer horror. My eyes had lingered too long on the obscene runic carvings that edged the joints of his armor, the insane sigils that decorated his chestplate. I was entranced, captivated by the golden chains that dressed his luridly painted armor, the gems and exquisite filigree covering his armor plate, the translucent silk of his cloak, and the words, the alien, abominable words inscribed upon his form, twitching and seething with secrets older than time. Secrets, promises, lies. I forced myself not to look. Soul-destroying madness lay in the marks and brands of chaos if one looked too long. Mandragore shrieked in fury and raised a massive gloved fist, spiked with rusty blades, to smash Lord Glor. The blow didn't fall. I started, as if slapped, as a burst of psychic power rippled across the concourse. Mandragore stepped back a pace. Datso moved towards him. Smaller than Glor or Locke, Datso seemed even more insignificant next to the monster, but with each step he took, the Chaos Marine moved backwards. He didn't speak, but I could hear his voice in my head. The presence and the words were so foul, I barely managed not to vomit.
"Mandragore Carrion, son of Fulgrim, worthy of Slaanesh.
champion of the Emperor's children, killer of the living, defiler of the dead, keeper of secrets, your presence here honors us, and we celebrate our pact with your fellowship. But you will not seek to harm us. Never raise your hand to us again. Never.
That so was simply the most potent psyker I had ever encountered. With his mind alone, he had forced down one of the vilest of the traitors, a space marine sworn to the corrupt service of chaos. Mandragore turned away and strode off across the compound. I saw now how Lord Glor wilted from the confrontation, his bravado spent. Many of the workers present were weeping with the trauma of the exchange, and two of the guards were throwing up. Shaking, I looked round at my companions. Fischig was ashen-faced and trembling, his eyes closed. Rizor had curled up in a ball in the ashy mud, his back against the wall. Bequin had vanished.